Our first guest has written a book about Jesus. His name is not Luke or Matthew. It's John. Dr. John Dixon, historian from the Centre for Public Christianity in Australia. The question is, well, at least the question in my mind, is why write a book about Jesus when it's already been done in the New Testament? To answer that, Dr. Dixon joins us now on the phone from Sydney, Australia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Brian. I'm thinking of giving up my writing career after that. They got it right in the first century, so it's all footnotes.
Exactly. Why did you do it? Why rewrite the New Testament? I assume that's basically what you're doing.
That's a great question, but I think the simple answer is, twofold. There are a lot of dodgy books out there that are just trying to whip up the latest sensationalist theory about the man from Nazareth. And on the other side, you've got a mountain of very boring, scholarly tomes on the life of Jesus that no one but the true nerds ever read. And what I thought would be a fun idea is to try and bring serious scholarship on the historical Jesus to the average person on the street without going for the crazy sensationalism that often gets out onto the street.
Now, what sort of books are you talking about there when you're talking about sensationalism? You're talking about something like The Da Vinci Code?
At one level... Yes, but that's a novel, and you know, I think we all knew that that was a novel, and we're all a little bit embarrassed that we ever took it so seriously. But I think of books written by some pop theologians who, you know, try and, you know, come up with the latest theory about Jesus being married to Mary Magdalene and having three children, or the historical Jesus not really ever preaching about judgment and only ever talking about love and coming out with themes about him that historians wouldn't sign off on. But because these books are written for the public, no one really checks up on them. I'm trying to do is be a bridge between the public and the academic work that's going on.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that in a moment, but there's one thing I'm thinking I want to ask you, which is why do you think some of those ideas seem to be so successful? I mean, you can write, I mean, even if it's a novel, I mean, The Da Vinci Code was very successful in terms, because people seem to like this idea that Jesus didn't die on the cross, he managed to survive that, and he had kids, and was an ordinary family man. Why is that so attractive to some people?
I think there are a couple of things. I think the first is a good conspiracy is hard to put down. And so, you know, all of us love the idea of there being some conspiracy out there. I think added to that is the fact that there's deep suspicion of religion, of the church. And so a book like The Da Vinci Code or any of the others that have traded on that gives us, or it confirms our impression that the church is not to be trusted, that the church has hidden the real Jesus, and now we're going to get back to the real Jesus. Now, I agree there's a little bit of that. The church has got in the way of Jesus over the centuries. But we need to make sure that we're doing good history, not just good conspiracy.
Now, the source material, the Bible, is there any other source material if you're going to write a book about Jesus?
There's plenty. Most historical tomes on the life of Jesus begin with a series of references to Jesus in non-Christian writings. We know of 11 references to Jesus from the first and second centuries, from people who weren't Christians. There's some Roman ones, there's some Greek, and there are a few Jewish ones as well. There are three that really capture the historian's attention and lead most historians to the point where they have no doubt whatsoever that he actually lived. And these are Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, Mara bar Serapion, a Stoic philosopher who mentions Jesus, and Tacitus, who's the greatest of the ancient Roman historians. He's the one we know most of what we know about the emperors because of. And he mentions Jesus in passing. So these three are the starting point, if you like. And they're very brief. They just say a paragraph here, a paragraph there, and tell us about this teacher who was known as the Christ, who some people thought could heal people, and so on. So there's little passing references that give us at least a peg in the ground. This man really lived. No one doing history doubts that. But then you've got to ask, what are the earliest sources? And that isn't Tacitus, Mara bar Serapion, or Josephus. The earliest datable sources for the life of Jesus are actually the Gospels, now in the New Testament, and the letters of Paul. And these sources aren't privileged by New Testament historians. They don't hold them as sacred texts, but nor are they prejudiced against them. Historians don't come to these texts thinking, ooh, they were written by religious people, so we can't trust them. Yeah, historians tend to approach the New Testament with this kind of nice balance between skepticism and a sense of trying to work out what's real within them. And it's partly because they were written so early that they're taken so seriously.
You mentioned various references to a man who was a teacher, some called the Christ, a healer. Mm-hmm. Would such a personality be that unusual, though, in the Middle East around about the year 0 AD?
Oh, well, at one level, no.
2nd century AD.
At one level, no. And this probably explains why we don't have a great many references to Jesus outside of those who were his followers, because although he did end up starting the world's largest religion, in his day, he was probably a minor prophet figure. It's frankly surprising to a lot of us sort of secular historians that he pops up at all in the writings of Tacitus and Josephus, partly because we know of other teachers. There were plenty of teachers wandering around. There were a few so-called healers. Jesus is slightly different in what's reported about him, but generally he fits into a pattern that we can say existed in the first century. I think there are a couple of things that are astonishing about Jesus that make him sort of stick out in the first century.
Yes.
Well,
you got me hanging there. Such as?
The list is very long. I think the death of this person on a Roman cross is unusual. I mean, there were lots of crucifixions, but how could a humble teacher and healer end up on what Romans called the summum supplicium, the ultimate judgment? What on earth did he do to get up the Romans' nose, to use a colloquial expression? So that's of great interest to historians. One of the other pieces of detail that comes from the Gospels themselves that pique the historian's interest is his constant fraternizing with the so-called sinners of his day. Now, there were great debates in the first century amongst those living in Jesus' country about who the sinners were and whether you were allowed to eat with them, be in their presence, touch them, and so on. And most people in his day said, no way, you can't have any association with them. Well, we know that Jesus broke all those boundaries.
Did that make him unusual compared to some of those other teachers, healers?
It is incredibly different, yes.
Yeah.
We don't have other figures who did that. And we have plenty of sources for this stuff. So we have great long works from Josephus. We have the beautiful Dead Sea Scrolls. We have a book called the Mishnah. There's plenty of sources for us to look at. And then you come to the Gospels, which present this Jewish teacher who sat down and ate and drank with those class sinners. Well, this fascinates historians. In fact, there are entire scholarly monographs written on the topic of Jesus' friendships with the sinners.
Do we know much about the people who wrote the Gospels, wrote the New Testament?
We know a little. We know a fair bit about the Apostle Paul, who produced a bunch of the letters that are now in the New Testament. We know he was one of the very early followers of Jesus. We know he claimed to actually be an eyewitness to the resurrection. We know he had relationships with lots of the other eyewitnesses of Jesus. And he writes within living memory of Jesus. We can trace a lot of his journeys. We can place a number of the events from his own life against what we know of secular history of the time. So he's a fairly certain character. It gets a little less certain when we turn out to the Gospels. Mark is probably our earliest Gospel, and it does look like it was written by a close companion of the Apostle Peter. It looks like Mark was an attempt of a companion of Peter to put down on paper what Peter had been preaching. We know a little about Luke as well, since Luke is also quite a prominent Christian in the second generation of Christians. He was personally acquainted with the first generation of Christians, but he's probably writing now in the 70s, so 30, 40 years after Jesus. And he's putting down on paper what the eyewitnesses had been saying for the last 30 or 40 years.
Paul himself, I've often wondered, how important was he in spreading the ideas of Christianity? Would Christianity have got more than a foothold, got a foothold in the Middle East if it hadn't been for Paul and his energy and his vision?
It's a very good question, very difficult to answer, but my gut feeling is that at the human level, Paul is the reason this weird Jewish renewal movement that were the early followers of Jesus broke the boundaries of Judaism and went to non-Jews, went out into Syria and into what we call Turkey and then right across to Greece and to Rome. Because Paul had this radical idea at the center of his vision of what it means to follow Jesus, and that is that Jesus is relevant not just for the Jewish people. He doesn't just fulfill Jewish prophecy about the Messiah. He is, in fact, the Lord of the whole world. That means the Lord of Corinthians, the Lord of people living in Ephesus, the Lord of people living in Rome. He's even the Lord of the emperors, Paul thought. And so this means that we need to go beyond the boundaries, and he did that in quite dramatic way. So humanly speaking, yes, Paul is the reason Christianity spread out from Galilee into the wider world.
I mean, that message, was that when Jesus was around, was he saying that same thing, or was he really speaking to the audience of the Jews alone?
Yeah, look, that's a fascinating question. Lots of debate amongst scholars about whether Jesus had any interest in Gentiles. I think the general consensus today is Jesus had a focused ministry on his Jewish people, that he'd come thinking he was fulfilling some of the prophecies of the Old Testament to renew Israel. But there's something to hold in mind. Even those prophecies in the Old Testament spoke about when Israel is renewed, it would benefit the whole world. So we need to hold that in mind. Jesus comes thinking he's coming to bless Israel and renew Israel, but because we know the Old Testament thought that that would have blessing for the whole world, we have to assume Jesus did envisage a message going out to the whole world, but he didn't actually make that explicit. I think what has happened in Paul is he has spotted something in Jesus that he believes to be the fulfillment of all that Old Testament tradition, that first comes the renewal of Israel, then comes blessing to the world. And Paul in particular looks at Jesus' own fraternizing with sinners, Jewish sinners of his day, and thinks to himself, hang on, if Jesus sat down with the immoral Jews of his day, it's not that great a leap for me to think I can sit down now with a non-Jew, which was unthinkable in Jesus' day, unthinkable in a lot of the Jewish texts we have from the period. But Paul does the unthinkable. He begins to argue that you can sit down at the table and have good relationships with people who aren't Jews, and that these people who aren't Jews can be full Christians without becoming Jews first.
What was the situation for the Jews around about the time of Jesus? The Romans had come in,
yep,
and they'd taken over.
Yep.
So things weren't too good for Israel.
60 years before Jesus, the Romans come in, and they ruled well in that they ruled with quite a lot of power, and they set up garrison towns around Israel. They enforced various taxes and established their own puppet kings and governors all across the land. Now, the Jews hated this. Now, of course, those who were aristocrats quite liked it because they got some benefits from being friendly with Rome. But the general population, from what we can tell, was quite anti-Rome. And a number of rebel movements amongst the Jews started up in the period of Jesus, just before Jesus and during his life and even after Jesus. Rebel movements that thought, in order for Israel to be who it truly should be, the Romans have to go. And so there were some violent uprisings, one in 4 BC, one in AD 6, and ultimately it climaxes in the year 70, so a generation after Jesus, when the whole nation rises up against Rome, and then Rome brings down the full might of its forces and destroys Jerusalem, razes it to the ground and burns the temple, and countless thousands of people are killed. So there is this movement in Jesus' day to violently evict the Romans. And it's in that context we hear Jesus saying things like, love your enemies, do good to those who persecute you, turn the other cheek. All that stuff is not about just being nice to the annoying neighbor over the back fence. It's actually about loving those despised Romans.
But also, this is a time when people in Israel, the Jews, are looking for somebody who can say, look, we can renew, we can have a renaissance. So that would have created a climate for people wanting to listen to this guy if he had charisma.
Oh, definitely. And the normal picture of this savior figure is very much a military figure. So we have some references in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in some other texts called the Pseudepigrapha, which refer to this mighty warrior who's known as the Messiah coming and destroying the enemies of God. So Jesus has a problem now. If he thinks he's the Messiah, but doesn't think the Messiah's role is to come with violence and to overthrow the Romans, what on earth does he do? Because if he says, I'm the Messiah, follow me, then people are going to think, right, well, I've got three swords and, you know, Auntie Joe has another sword and, you know, we can all go together and boot out the Romans. And so he has to be a little bit secret about how he goes about his ministry. And this is why readers of the Gospels have often puzzled, why is Jesus not more explicit about who he is? Sure, he teaches all sorts of lovely things. He gives hints of his authority, but why doesn't he come right out and say, here I am, I'm the Messiah you've all been waiting for? Well, I think the answer is he didn't want to buy into the typical military vision of a first century Messiah. He wanted to lay this groundwork of teaching about love and about renewal before he made it clear that he had some kind of authority. That seems to be our best historical guess.
You're listening tonight on Radio New Zealand National. I'm talking to Dr. John Dixon. He's an historian from the Centre for Public Christianity in the United, not in the United States, in Australia, just across the Tasman. He's written a book called Jesus, A Short Life. And I wanted to ask you, John, how is it structured? How do you go about telling this story?
Well, we begin with what are the sources about his life. And you and I have already begun that conversation.
Yeah.
And then we move through to some of his vital statistics. Exactly when was he born? What was Galilee like when he grew up there? Some of the stuff that we've already talked about. What were the Jewish living conditions like? What was it like to live under Roman domination? So we move through all of that. And then we move into some of the actual teachings of Jesus, where we cover this theme of love of enemies, which was so radical in his day. And I could probably add, I find it just as radical today, actually. We look at his strange circle of friends. So Jesus collected a great band of people known as sinners who loved him and followed him and were his disciples. He also had quite a lot of support from women, which was unusual. We don't have any other evidence for rabbis in the period having female disciples. And Jesus clearly, throughout the Gospels, anyone can just pick up, say, the Gospel of Luke, and you find women everywhere in his ministry. Then the book moves towards discussion of the healings of Jesus, which for a historian is a little bit problematic, but the problem for the historian is it's everywhere in our sources. Not only the Christian sources, but the non-Christian sources refer to Jesus doing things that people thought were healing. So, yeah, hey, we've got to sort of grapple with how on earth that ended up in the historical record. And eventually we move toward the causes of his crucifixion and what the historian can say about the aftermath of Jesus, the so-called resurrection.
When did Jesus begin his religious work, his spiritual work?
We think about AD 28. Luke describes it as the 15th year of Emperor Tiberius. Now, that doesn't mean when he was age 15. It means the 15th year of the reign of Emperor Tiberius. Well, we know when Tiberius began to reign, AD 14. Add 15 years to that, it's about AD 28, that Jesus goes public, and he's public for just a few years.
And that period of time, before that, do we know much about what he did? He was my understanding, he's a carpenter, right?
Yeah. I've got a whole section on the so-called missing years, because whenever there's not information in the Gospels, people try and fill in the blanks and speculate. So I've heard theories about, you know, he spent some time in Egypt where he learned magic. There's no evidence for that, but, you know, it's one theory. And recently I even had a woman explain to me that she thought Jesus went to Tibet to learn Buddhism. And that's why he came back to Israel telling people to be nice to each other, because he got that from Buddhism. So there are all sorts of wonderful speculations. But most historians, in fact, I think I'd have to say every historian who's a specialist in this stuff, thinks, as boring as it sounds, he probably just grew up like any normal Jewish kid living in Galilee, taking on his father's business, which was carpentry. He grew up learning how to make locks and doors and tools and houses, and did that right up until the year 28, as I said.
What's the most important aspect of his life for you?
I think I'd have to say his humility, because that this is such an incredible life that he lives, and he speaks with such composure, he speaks with such authority, and yet throughout his life he is humble. This is a theme that struck at the very beginning of the story in the Christmas narratives about him being laid in a manger. I mean, this is not just a pretty romantic story. This is striking the theme of humility. Hey, the Messiah of the world laid in an animal feeding trough. And that theme weaves its way all through his teaching about love and humility and kindness, and ends up to the point of his crucifixion, where he allows brutal powers to conquer him, to dominate him, but he does it willingly. And if you've been a careful reader of the Gospels up to that point, he actually thinks he's sacrificing himself for others.
Yeah, well,
that for me is potent, this humility for the sake of others.
That issue, though, of sacrificing, Jesus sacrificing his life for us, so that we can get out of jail with God. Because I've had a lot of, particularly Christians, I guess, fundamentalist Christians have argued that Adam and Eve sinned and they didn't follow God's word, got into trouble, and humanity is in trouble until Jesus comes along. He dies on the cross for all our sins, every sin happening now, every sin that's ever happened, ever will happen, and if we believe in Jesus, we get into paradise. So that's the most important thing about the Christ story for those people.
Yeah, and I can see what they're getting at. I mean, that's an extension in some ways of what I've been saying about this incredible humility, this sense that he was giving himself for others. But there are kind of two questions in what you're saying. The one is, what is the modern religious implication of it? And the other question that I'm more able to answer is, what did the historical Jesus think in his day, in his Jewish context, think he was doing, allowing himself to be crucified? And the answer most historians give is, we do know that the ancient Jews believed in a sacrificial system, that lambs and goats were sacrificed in the temple as atonement for the sins of Israel. And Jesus is brought up in this tradition, as horrible as it may sound to some of us. I think there's no avoiding the fact that when Jesus, at his Last Supper, says, my body broken for you, my blood poured out for you, he is thinking of this sacrificial Jewish theology. I mean, we can forget modern Christian fundamentalist theology. Just speaking as a historian, it looks like Jesus is adopting this Jewish theology of a sacrifice for the sins of others. He sees himself as that sacrifice. It's a strange idea, I admit, but it's one that he taught.
One of the other important things that is often is that what Jesus is saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I'm not a theologian. I could be quoting this wrong. I'm not a Bible scholar. But no one comes to God but through me. In other words, you've got to believe in Christianity to be saved. Or is that a completely illogical or incorrect interpretation of what he said? Have I even got his words wrong?
He does, in the Gospel of John, chapter 14, say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. So it's what he said, and he said very many similar things. It is one of the awkward things about Jesus. I mean, just speaking as a historian, I come across all sorts of things that don't make me at all comfortable from the lips of Jesus. But as a historian, I've got to say, well, regardless of how it makes me feel, I've got to make sure I don't massage what Jesus said to make it more palatable.
Yeah.
I know some sort of nice, slippery theologians try that today, and theologians are able to do whatever they want, and then the fundamentalists on the other side sort of turn up the heat on what Jesus said. But what I'm trying to do in this book, certainly, is to be fair to the historical Jesus. And the reality is, he did say stuff like, he is the way to God. He is the only way to God. Now, you and I have perfect freedom to say, well, I think he got that wrong. But the reality is, he did say stuff like that.
I know other people, and then this is a bloke who's a New Age thinker who's been around for a while recently, Eckhart Tolle, Power of Now, and he's argued that Christ is not so much a historical person as a state of being.
Yeah. Again, to me, that's just another reflection of the kind of modern pop theology that you can get nowadays that's divorced from the history. Jesus is anything you want to make him. You know, for some, he's the right-wing Jesus. For others, he's the left-wing Jesus. You can end up making Jesus whatever you want him to be.
Yeah.
And the discipline of history, being a historian, is to try and say, well, I don't care what I want him to be. I just want to know what the sources say he was, and then I can deal with the question. But someone like Eckhart Tolle, and there are plenty of other sort of modern gurus, Deepak Chopra, for example, has written a book on Jesus recently. They're entitled to their views, but their views don't have anything to do with the historical evidence we have. They're just kind of modern theoretical views, and we can take them or leave them.
Who influenced Jesus then?
Oh, great question. And again, there's enormous debate on this, but I think I'd be fair in saying most scholars think the biggest influence on Jesus, outside of him just reading the Old Testament scriptures, was John the Baptist. Now, we know John the Baptist was a very important figure of first century Judaism, not just from the Gospels, but from non-Christian sources that refer to John the Baptist. And it does seem that this Baptist character was calling for Israel's renewal by demanding that they leave Jerusalem to come out to him by the Jordan River and get baptized. Well, baptism was like a spiritual bath. It was a way of saying, begin again, get renewed. And the idea of going out to the Jordan River was a new beginning for Israel, because Israel, thousands of years before, had entered into Israel, the nation had entered into the promised land through the Jordan. And so John the Baptist is saying, come back out to the Jordan and begin again. And Jesus, all the Gospels tell us this, was caught up in that movement. He actually revered the Baptist and went and actually himself was baptized by John. That's the beginning of Jesus' ministry. In all four Gospels, we begin with the Baptist, not Jesus, the Baptist, who calls for Israel's renewal and calls people for baptism. And only after Jesus' baptism in the year 28 does he then go out and go public with his own vision of what the renewal of Israel means.
And where do you think that vision, though, which involved talking to sinners, loving sinners, accepting them, where did that idea of non-judgment, where did that come from then?
Well, there's two things to hold in mind here. The first is that I don't want to give the impression he didn't speak about judgment, because, again, here's one of those things that makes me uncomfortable, but as a historian, I have to face it. He preached judgment. He did have this very strong idea that God's judgment was going to come and make everything right in the world, and everything that was wrong in the world was going to get wiped out. So he did share that vision. But he seems to have spotted in a couple of Old Testament passages which pop up in his teaching. I'm thinking particularly of Isaiah 61. Perhaps listeners may like to dust off their Bible and go to Isaiah 61. And you get this very strange passage about some servant of the Lord coming along and freeing the prisoners and giving good news for the poor. And it's a very sort of liberating vision of what God wanted to do in the world. And Jesus seems to have picked up on that theme and run with it and crystallized it in his own ministry.
I know you mentioned earlier a woman who argued to you that maybe he went off to Tibet and then came back, and you think, no, that didn't happen. Is it possible that any of the ideas from the East could have got to the Middle East by now and have influenced somebody like Jesus?
It's certainly within the realms of possibility, but we don't have any evidence of it. That's the problem. We do have a little bit of evidence of trade between the Far East and the Middle East, but we don't have much evidence of ideas being cross-pollinated, if you like. The other problem with the idea of Jesus going to Tibet is that we now know Buddhism itself didn't reach Tibet until the 5th century after Christ. In the 1st century, the people of Tibet were worshippers of Bon, which was an animistic deity. So Jesus didn't get that, obviously. I'm not ruling out the idea of some concepts coming from the East toward the Middle East, but there isn't evidence for it. And actually, we can find almost everything Jesus says, we can find glimpsed already in his Old Testament scriptures, but he crystallizes it and intensifies it in various ways. So it's better to go with what we know than what we don't know.
One other thing that I wanted to ask you, I'm fascinated with, is why you think that the religions that came out of Judaism, Islam and Christianity, spread so successfully in the 1,000 years after Jesus died.
Well,
died and was resurrected, depending on your point of view, of course.
Yes. You know, I feel like saying my entire doctorate was on that question. How on earth did earliest Christianity spread in the Roman world? And I have to say, I don't really know, which sounds pretty pathetic for someone who's meant to have a PhD in it. But what I'm saying is, I know what the early Christians did to try and promote Christianity. But I can't humanly explain it, because what we have in earliest Christianity is an explosion of interest in this strange little movement with this man who died on a terrible Roman cross, and people are flocking to the movement. The early Christians for the first couple of centuries were being regularly killed, some crucified just like their master, others fed to the lions, others just heads chopped off and so on. And yet people still flocked to them. And I think the key was this incredible vision of a humble savior, of a person who gave himself for others. That was such an antithesis to the Roman way of thinking, and yet powerfully attractive. So that's my hunch, but like I say, I'm still not sure. It's quite different when we zoom forward 600 years to the birth of Islam, because Islam started as a political movement, quite unlike the Jesus movement. Islam was in fact a nation state up in Medina, and then they came and they took Mecca, and so it's easier to understand the spread of Islam, because Islam had armies, Islam had great political leaders. Christianity didn't have anything like that for the first 300 years.
Then, of course, Christianity got lucky, though, when the Roman Empire did adopt it. And that must have been pretty crucial, really, wasn't it?
You could say lucky. Some of us who are historians think it all went downhill from there, but that's a point of dispute, I guess. It's true, the Roman Emperor Constantine did come to be enamored with Jesus. And, he had a so-called conversion. And then he did what most of us who are historians quite deplore. He tried to write Christianity into Roman legislation. Instead of just allowing it to be a movement of persuasion, a movement of service, a kind of alternative community within the larger community, he tried to legislate Christianity. And I think there are parallels here for the modern world as Christian churches and political movements try and legislate their beliefs in our secular laws. I think it's deeply problematic and quite counter the original intention of Jesus, which was to win the world through humility and service and persuasion.
When was the Centre for Public Christianity, the centre that you've worked for and you associate this book has come from, this movement, when was that set up?
2 years ago. We are an independent organisation that's trying to promote the public understanding of the Christian faith using the best of scholarship and the best of media. And anyone can go to publicchristianity.org and knock themselves out, because it's full of free videos and articles and book reviews and so on.
It's not a church for academics.
It's not. It's not a church at all. In fact, the centre was kind of born out of a little frustration with the churches. I mean, we're friendly with churches, but a little frustration that churches aren't communicating to the wider community in New Zealand and Australia. And so what the centre is trying to do is not address Christians at all, not address the churches at all, but to try and bring some sense and clarity to the burning questions many people outside the church have about this ancient faith.
Are you a Christian yourself, John?
You know, I balk at saying that. I think, you know, if you came and watched my life for a little bit, you'd end up saying, yeah, you've got to say he's a Christian. But I'm not really one of those card-carrying types, and I'm a little bit nervous about associating with the title Christian, simply because it means so many different things for different people.
But
if you ask me, do I think Jesus is important? Am I trying to live my life in light of his reality? The answer is definitely yes.
But that interest in spirituality, it's burning. I mean, you can hear it in your voice. Where does that come from?
Well, I grew up in a completely unreligious household. I'd never been inside a church before I was 15 or 16 years of age. But we have this little relic in Australia, a little relic of our Christian past. I'm not sure if it's the same in New Zealand. It's called scripture lessons. In state primary schools and high schools, they have this 1 hour a week where volunteers from the local churches can come up and teach the Bible, or mosques can send people to, you know, talk about Islam. And it's this 1 hour little program. It's still in most schools in New South Wales. And I got a scripture teacher when I was in year 9, so I guess I was 15, who was normal and Christian at the same time. And I'd never met one of those. I'd met this sort of crazy. And this middle-aged mother had a way with words, had answers to all my smart aleck questions, and had a capacity for pointing me back to the life of Jesus. That's where my journey began. It was this incredibly intelligent, funny, warm, generous-hearted, middle-aged mum who pointed me to the Gospels for the first time in my life as a, say, 16-year-old. And it's been quite a journey since.
I want to finish with this question because we talked about Jesus saying, I am the way, the truth, the light, and if you want to go to God, I'm the only way, no other way, which is controversial. And as you mentioned, some people try to get out of that and other people stick to it really hard and fast. But can we be truly good, do you think, if we're only being good to get into heaven?
No. And I think most skeptical people are right to say, hang on, you Christians. You know, you can't just be trying to avoid hell by being good, because then you're not really being good. You're just doing it not for any altruistic motive. You're doing it simply because you want to escape the fires of judgment. Well, I think the thing Christians who hold that in mind have to remember is the Bible doesn't actually say that. You don't find many passages in the Bible at all that say turn or burn, right? The motivation for loving, for living the life of Christian love, throughout the New Testament, certainly in the teaching of Jesus, is precisely that God is love. It isn't that you're going to get a big stick whack over the head. It's that there is a God and he loves the world. And if you want to live in the world according to reality, you love. So my own approach to this is I don't think for a second I'm trying to live a life of love in order to earn my way to heaven. Not for a second. It's the other way around. It's because I feel so loved by the source of all things, by the Jesus who really lived and died and rose again, that I try and love in thankfulness for that love I've been given. That's the proper mode. And I think skeptics are right to spot the opposite and to think it stinks.
John, it's been great talking to you. Thanks very much for speaking to us today.
Thank you, Brian.
That's Dr. John Dixon, an historian from the Centre for Public Christianity in Australia. His new book, Jesus, A Short Life, is out now. It's published by Lion.